through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Big show coming at you today. Going to talk to our friend Yogi Roth coming up at 1 o'clock. Talk through all these movements that are going on in college football to see if we're even going to have a college football season. So that's obviously a big topic on many of our minds. Mike Salk will be coming up at 12:30. By the way, this hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy brought to you by Car Toys. You know, guys, we talk about the Mariners so much in this 60-game season. In the context of, like, you know what, doesn't matter. Whatever we get. Wins and losses don't matter. I kind of wish the Seahawks were in that position this year. Because every time this topic comes up, you guys hit me with, oh, God, well, we got to win now. We got Jamal Adams. We've given up the draft picks. Got to develop those young players right now, right now. Got to win now. I'm not so sure, A, that I'm comfortable with that, and B, that I agree with it. But Stacy and Jake are on my case today about this. So I'm going to let Stacy take it and tell me why these young players need to develop immediately.
So here's where it starts. And it's not just like a random idea or conversation. I actually think it's really, really important. So obviously, like you said, the Seahawks traded away their next two first-round picks to the Jets in order to get Jamal Adams. Now, that's important not just because those are your two most valuable draft picks, so those are potentially two of your best players you're bringing in, but that could also be a lot more than two players should you trade back. So they're also potentially trading a lot of depth pieces that they could have acquired to help with special teams or backups in case of injuries. There's a lot you give up when you do that. And so the guys that they've drafted in the last couple of years have become even more important to this team, not just for depth and not just in the roles they already had, but as guys that need to shine in the next 2 years when the Seahawks are no longer going to have guys to bring in. So you're talking about guys like Rasheem Green, and I'm going to also include Jordan Brooks, Daryl Taylor, and Alton Robinson, who were brought in to help the defense this year, though they haven't really hit the field yet, so it feels a bit unfair, but it is important that they develop. Rashad Penny, I think people are waiting for him to develop, especially since he and Collier were two first-round picks. You look at the production from both of those guys this past season. Collier appeared in 11 games with no starts, no sacks, and had just three tackles. Penny appeared through most of the season but had 370 yards. You start to see him kind of come into his own toward the end of the season. He and Carson did start to look like kind of a 1-2 punch, but obviously he suffered a season-ending ACL injury, and that didn't work out. So, again, it is incredibly important that these two guys continue to work for this team. And in cut number two right here, John Schneider says that they still have some hope for these guys despite their bad luck with past picks.
You know, we lost Malik in a tragic, you know, four-wheeler incident and, you know, was never able to play football again. Rashad Penny, you know, had probably the best medical grade we ever had on anybody, and he comes in and gets hurt right away, you know. So, and then LJ Collier last year, you know, nobody's even seen him yet. We thought we were going to lose him for the season. He had a very rough, like, kind of NBA-ish high ankle sprain.
So I know that's tough luck, and I personally, and I don't know where you guys stand on this, am expecting more from LJ Collier this year now that he's presumably going to have a full, healthy offseason. But it's so important these guys continue to develop because they're also under club control for the Seahawks. These aren't guys that are going to be needing a contract this upcoming year or next year. These are guys the Seahawks can have help them now on the cheap.
Well, and as they can help them now on the cheap, you have to understand as well, guys, that this is a franchise under John Schneider and Pete Carroll that pride themselves on building their team through the draft and developing talent. If you miss on picks or are not able to develop that talent, it leaves you heavily relying on your star talent. Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, DK Metcalf. Now you add Jamal Adams, Jaron Reed. And you're constantly trying to fill massive holes on your roster on a short-term basis. Look at the offensive line. That has been a constant short-term try and fill, mix and match almost every single year. And so you look at, you know, their acquisitions in free agency, oftentimes those are on smaller term deals, short term deals, because they're trying to fill holes and spread the wealth across the roster, especially over the last couple of years, because they've had so many holes to fill rather than having guys like Rasheem Green, LJ Collier, you know, step up in a big way to where they don't need to, or they don't feel like they need to address those holes. So it's an interesting spot for this group to be in. But the question that I want to pose back to you, Tom and Stacey, is it more important that these young players develop on this team? Or is it more important that their star players who are already shining continue to keep playing at a very high level, Pro Bowl, All-Pro type of level?
I think it's both, Jake, but here's the thing. No matter what team you're on and no matter what situation you're in, I think it's always important for your young players to develop, right? I mean, otherwise you're just missing on draft picks. But if you guys are saying that it's important for them to develop this year, why is that? Is it because you think that they need to win the Super Bowl now? I actually think that you're always kind of in win now mode, but when I say win now, what I mean is, like, you remain competitive, you make the playoffs. If they end up signing Jamal Adams to a long-term deal and he's with the team for, like, the rest of his career, like he said he wants to be, I think that the window for this team to win has just extended itself by about, I don't know, 5 years or so. So I don't know that they're in Super Bowl or bust mode. In fact, I'm going to say right now that they're not. Would I like to see that their young players develop? Yeah, absolutely. If they don't, then they're going to have to do another rebuild, and they're going to have fewer core players at the end of that. They're going to be left with probably Russell Wilson, maybe the end of Bobby Wagner, Jamal Adams, and then you got DK and maybe Tyler Lockett. But I don't think that they have to, that these guys have to develop into big time players, all of them, A. But for the ones that do, it's not to the extent that they have to win the Super Bowl this year. I just think that that's putting too much pressure on a lot of different guys, many of which I don't see really getting there. And I know Stacey's going to go through the list of players here in a second, maybe with some others, but I'll just give you one for example. I don't know that Cody Barton's going to develop into a big-time player, just as an example. I think he's going to be a good special teams player, maybe a good backup, but I'm looking at guys like Daryl Taylor to be part of the core, Jordan Brooks to be part of the core. If Trey Flowers doesn't work out, maybe ship him out of here, get somebody else. Damian Lewis be part of the core. That's how I'm looking at it.
But also, I think that maybe it's not that if they have it's not Super Bowl or bust now in terms of this year, but you have this window that you do need to win. And I think you have a talented enough roster to be able to pull it off this year. And if those young players, Rasheem Green, Daryl Taylor, Jordan Brooks, Marquise Blair, Shaquille Griffin continues to develop, Trey Flowers has a much better year in year three than he does in year two, it puts your team in a more advantageous situation. And the problem is, Tom, is if these young players do not develop, if they do not develop and become good rotational players at the minimum, then the problem you have is that core that you're talking about is at an all-time low. And so now if you're John Schneider and Pete Carroll, one, you gave up two first-round picks that you can't trade back to try and develop more depth, and B, you're also looking at free agency where you're having to try and spread the wealth of your money to fill these holes instead of getting more bang for your buck at two or three positions that can really take you to the next level. So that's all in the big landscape of this window. I think that's why, Stacey, you came out and said that these young players have to develop. Rasheem Green and LJ Collier and Damian Lewis and Shaquille Griffin, Marquise Blair, Jordan Brooks, all these guys, they need to continue to develop for this program in order for it to take truly the next step from squeezing into the playoffs every year because of their star talent and really becoming a Super Bowl-laden type of roster.
Man, Tom, I get what you're saying with, like, maybe all these guys don't need to develop right now. Like, is it that important that Cody Barton become a pro bowler this year when he's going to be in a backup role and on special teams and you've still got Bobby Wagner? Like, no, it's not vital that Cody Barton develop that quickly into the best player he can be. But what I will say is you don't often see guys suddenly, and we mentioned this ahead of the show, in year three, year four, break out. And suddenly be that guy. It happens, but I think you want to see more flashes of that with these guys earlier in these careers that you have with them in Seattle. And I do think for some guys it is important to have it happen this year. It's unfair to put a lot of that pressure on Daryl Taylor, but I think that his timeline for how soon he has to develop and make an impact has been sped up as a result of the kind of misses on this defensive line. Likewise, Rashim Green, there's a lot of pressure on him, more pressure on him than there is a guy like Cody Barton, because you've got depth at linebacker that you don't have on the defensive line. So for some guys, I do think 2020, this offseason, this training camp, is the time when they need to step up.
Well, I said that they need to remain competitive the next 2 years. Otherwise, they're going to be without draft picks, right? That's the biggest thing right there, because if you go 5-11, 6-10, and you don't have first round picks, you could be in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to remain competitive. So in order to remain competitive, they are going to need some of these guys to step up. But you know what? If none of them do, that means that Pete and John just don't know how to draft. Like, this is something that I'm just not that worried about. I still believe in their.
You're not worried
to
about
draft.
your GM and your head coach not being able to draft?
Do you think they don't know?
I mean,
how
that's
to
a
draft?
Problem to build for the future.
I'm not worried about it.
Ooh, hot take, Tom. Hot take. It doesn't concern
me. I gave them an A this past year.
You did. You gave them the highest grade of anyone here. But would it? So it wouldn't concern you if a lot of those picks didn't work out?
No, it would, but I'd be surprised.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
I mean, I acknowledge that the last couple of drafts have not been pretty. But some of that is luck. Some of it's bad drafting, but every team has some bad drafting. So I'm just not at the point yet where I'm pointing the finger at Pete and John saying, you guys have no idea what you're doing.
Right, and I agree with you on that. I think that there should still be hope, and that's why I think that coming today and looking at training camp and looking at these guys and looking at this team heading into 2020, they have an awesome opportunity in front of them to be able to go and chase the Super Bowl. It's not unrealistic for them to go and chase the Super Bowl this year and legitimately have a chance. They have the star talent. And to go to, you know, that conversation, I don't believe that this team, all of a sudden, the bottom is going to fall out. They have too good of superstar talent for that to happen. They have too good of a head coach for that to happen. I believe that when we're having this conversation, the star talent for it to come through, Russell Wilson, Tyler Lockett, Chris Carson, Jamal Adams, Bobby Wagner, you throw in Jaron Reed because they're paying him like a superstar, mm-hmm. Shaquille Griffin. If those players can continue to play at a Pro Bowl, All-Pro level, DK Metcalf, you're looking at a team that is always going to be in the hunt for the division, for the NFC, you know, conference, but they have to have some help along the way for them to be a legitimate Super Bowl roster and not just squeak by with a 7-point point differential, you know, competing for the NFC championship.
I know it probably doesn't sound like it to our audience, but in this conversation, I'm the most positive person.
You know what? It's true. Although someone did try to clown you on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line, Tom. They said, well, also, maybe Tom isn't worried about drafting because he's a New York Giants fan and he's used to bad drafting.
Oh,
by comparison, like what the Seahawks are doing is genius. That's maybe true. That's not a bad point. Thanks for clowning me. I feel so clowned. All right, three questions. Let's go.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the we got to protect the kids nonsense.
Three Astros got hit by pitches last night, including one guy who got hit twice. If Rob Manfred did punish the Astros harder to begin with, do you guys think that they would get thrown at anyway, Stacey?
No. Maybe a couple times, but I think the fact that they didn't get punished at all is what's going to make teams that have nothing to do with this want to punish them too. And fans of teams like Mariners fans that are like, did the Astros keep you from the World Series? No. But Mariners fans are still calling for on day one, Jake, Marco Gonzalez to hit some of these guys and being a couple guys
off
the bat.
You're
so
right.
I think that a lot of people wanting this to happen and wanting this like people's justice is the fact that they weren't punished at all. So no, I don't think they would be.
No, they would not be thrown at this way. If the players felt like there was justice, if there was legitimate punishment that had occurred here, then no, I would not be talking about advocating for Marco Gonzalez on opening day to throw at one of the Astro players. One, it's not even in my nature. So just think about that for a second. I don't really like pitchers, like the code of baseball, throwing at each other and things like that. And I was sitting there advocating for it. That's how bad I think the Astro players got off with something that they should have been severely punished for. So if Manfred had been a little harsher, I don't think this happens.
I think guys like Joe Kelly were mad enough where they still might have done it. Now, last night...
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, last night, Joe Kelly. Three guys getting hit and Toro got hit twice. I don't know that we see that. But Joe Kelly went out there on a mission. Like, he was mad regardless of whatever punishment was or was not handed down. I think that they would probably be under attack by pitchers to some extent, maybe not to this extent. Next.
Number two.
Do you guys think that people who gamble regularly on sports actually enjoy sports? Like, could they watch sports for a couple of months, maybe a whole year, without gambling and enjoy it? Stacey?
I'm not a gambler. I don't gamble. But the people I know that do are sports fans. Like, I think the people I know that do it most are people my age who are especially fans of college sports. So I have a fantasy football thread where a lot of guys in there will do that. And then I have another friend who always does that. So I think it's just, I don't know. It's I think it happens a lot. And they're all sports fans. Side note, that's what I meant to say. They're all huge football fans.
I think that you can enjoy games, but not nearly in the same way. Some people, I think, gamble to bring more energy and excitement and drama to the games themselves. But to me, I'm sorry, I could not live that lifestyle. I really couldn't. Jim Moore, I'm not sure how you do it. Jim seems to be calm and relaxed enough where he's just like, I lost some money. I won some money. It doesn't really matter to me. I just kind of do it for the fun of it. But I would be a nervous wreck. I would be an emotional wreck if I ever gambled on a game.
Somebody on Twitter here, I put up a poll about it, by the way, at Tom Wassel. Somebody says, Edmonton is full of degenerate gamblers. We have a casino attached to the rink. Wouldn't have it any other way. By the way, I asked that same question in the Twitter poll. For those of you who gamble regularly on sports, could you enjoy the game without betting on it? Be honest. 79% say yes. Yeah, right.
You don't think that's true?
Yeah, right.
I think it just adds another layer for people.
I think that people who do it regularly depend on it. And they're going to be, if they had to quit, they have no idea what they're in for.
I mean, that might be like a gambling addiction.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Number three.
Do Should Justin Dunn feel too bad about giving up home runs to Mike Trout and Albert Pujols in the same inning last night? The first inning, by the way. Stacey.
You know,
or Jake, I don't care.
I'm going to say no, with the exception that even outside of that, it wasn't a great outing. Curtis and I were actually talking about it before the show, just kind of talking about, especially with such a promising week from the start of that lineup where Marco was great.
Taiwan's great.
Taiwan's fantastic.
Yusei was great.
And then kind of looking at Justice Sheffield and Dunn both struggling. I think in very different ways, though, because Sheffield had a stretch there of a couple innings where he didn't allow a hit and looked fantastic, and it just kind of fell apart for him at the end. It felt like Dunn, and I really like him, and I wanted him to turn it around. It felt like he couldn't really get going. Jake, what do you think?
Yeah, just a young player in Justin Dunn who is, you know, really trying to get his big league experience in. And no, I don't feel too bad about him giving home runs early in his young career to Trout and Pujols. They seem to be, you know, some pretty good, historically good batters who are known to take the ball out of the yard. So if you're done, it's kind of a welcome to the league rookie type of moment.
Yeah.
And I think that you learn from those, you grow from them, you have a little bit of a smile on your face afterwards, just saying, man, those two all-time greats got the best of me, and hopefully I can get them back, you know, later down the road. So, no, I'm not too worried about that.
By the way, Mike Trout is a new proud papa. What do you think the chances are that kid's going to be MVP or Rookie of the Year in like 2043?
I hope he becomes a chess champion. I hope he becomes a Rubik's Cube champion. I'm very into Rubik's Cubes now.
Yeah, that's all Stacey wants to talk about is Rubik's Cubes at this point. But it was funny, actually, when watching the game, Scott Servais had a pretty a funny comment during the game while he was being interviewed by Mike Blowers and Dave Sims. And he just, you know, they were asking him about Mike Trout, and he was like, yeah, I was hoping the dad bod would kick in on Mike Trout and slow him down a little, but that doesn't seem to have happened. And then Curtis Rogers, it makes more sense to me, you know, what Curtis said. It's like the league better watch out because Mike Trout now, on top of everything else, has dad strength.
Yeah, that's the toughest dad kind of strength there is.
There sure is.
I mean, absolutely. Jake can attest to that. He'd snap us all
in these guns now. Proud papa, too.
I thought that mom's strength was the best.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
When your kid's trapped under a car,
yeah,
the mom can, like, lift
it's,
up
it's
the car.
It's the greater strength.
Yeah.
Yes,
dad's strength
the greater of the two.
Is still impressive.
Dad's
but mom's
strength is cool, but yes, can confirm. I'm not a mom, but I feel like that's something that would happen. Did I tell you guys all my
Mike
bunnies Salk's ran away?
They did?
Yeah, speaking of moms, I'm really sad.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. It's not. I'm devastated.
Mike Salk has dad strength. We know that for a fact. We'll ask him if the young players on the Seahawks need to develop too sweet. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
Great to have Mike Salk on the phone. We're just talking about dad strength a couple seconds ago. I'm sure that Mike Salk now has a ton of dad strength. Although, let me ask you this, Mike. Over time, does dad strength dissipate? Or does it only... is it at its best when your kids are newborn?
Yeah, I've found more of like a dad napping strength as opposed to actual strength. I've not experienced the bump in strength that is supposed to come with being a dad. But then again,
understand.
I've never had to like lift a car off of my kids or anything like that.
Well, that's the mother's job. That's mom's strength. Like when you hear those stories, that's always the mother.
Right.
Right.
Right. Hey, so three Astro hitters were hit by pitches last night, including one guy, Toro, who got hit twice. Do you think that if Manfred had punished the Astros more severely to begin with, that they would be getting hit by pitches at this rate?
I think it probably there would have been fewer. Yeah, I think more guys would have said, all right, justice was done, and so the game doesn't need to police itself. So, yeah, I think that's a pretty worthy argument to make. I still think there probably would be some players, and specifically on teams like the Dodgers, who feel like they were specifically cheated out of something, that would have wanted to exact some sort of a revenge inside the game. But, yeah, I mean, I think the fact that Rob Manfred never fully went through the process of making anyone who was associated from a player perspective suffer any consequences means that players want to do that themselves. I mean, and that's probably not that different from how many people would react. When you see people around you that are affecting you in a negative way, not have to have any accountability or consequences for that, you have a tendency to want to institute a little vigilante justice.
So, Salk, do you think Manfred, as he's watching the Astro players get hit and routinely get hit, do you think he's looking at this situation going, maybe I didn't handle this one all that right?
I hope not. I hope he's just sort of shrugging his shoulders and saying, well, what goes around comes around. I mean, that I hope is his answer. I'm sure it's not. I'm sure if you were to ask him, he would say my hands were tied. That the way the union works and the way this whole thing went down, I didn't have the power that I needed to make them suffer the consequences. And so this is the only result left. And because he doesn't want to go overboard punishing people that hit players, although I would say he did with Joe Kelly, I think that suspension was way too severe. He's now in a position where he either needs to let it go or run the risk of punishing players who hit Astros more than the actual Astros who committed the original offense, which is a lousy way to do it. But I think he would say my hands are tied based on the rules.
Hey, Mike, we opened the show talking about, obviously, the Seahawks trade for Jamal Adams and how important this offseason particularly is for their young players. Tom doesn't buy necessarily that, like, now's the offseason those guys have to develop, but do you think that they really need to start moving on guys like Rasheem Green and LJ Collier, that they need to step up this year to make those two first-round picks sting a little less?
Yes, I think they do need to. Both of those two, and then throw Marquise Blair in there. I mean, those are sort of three guys that were chosen at or near the top of the draft for them that are being counted on to do something. And especially in Rasheem Green and LJ Collier's place, that, you know, the two people you just named, they're in a position of weakness right now for the Seahawks, right? That positional group is not a strength. At least Marquise Blair, you can kind of cover for it because you've got two other safeties, and I think you like the way your secondary looks in general. As I said, I'm not going to expect much out of the rookies. I'm not going to expect that Jordan Brooks or Darrell Taylor, any of these guys, comes in and has an incredible, you know, rookie season based on the fact they're not even going to get a preseason to try that out. But for Collier and for Rasheem Green, yeah, I mean, I think in many ways they're banking on those guys doing something beyond what they've done in the past because they haven't upgraded from those positions. LJ Collier is a first-round pick a year ago, and he did Bubkis last year. Now, I like him. I liked what he brought to the table when they made the draft pick. And I understand that, you know, you suffer an ankle injury like he did early and maybe your whole season just never gets on track. So fine, but get it on track now. Like they need him as a first round pick to not be a bust, especially coming just a few years after the Malik McDowell disaster.
On a scale of 1 to 10 relative to the rest of the league, where would you rate Pete and John as drafters?
Well, you're going to give me their first few years in office or their last few years in office?
No, you can mix that in.
In the first few, they were 10 out of 10. They were the best drafters in the league. What they did in those first three or four drafts, I don't know if it'll ever be topped. However, since then, I would say they've been near the bottom of the league. I mean, they've gotten a couple of stars, so they're not like 32nd. Obviously, getting Frank Clark, Tyler Lockett, you know, and DK Metcalf here a year ago. Chris Carson, I think, is a positive. They've had some good players, Jaron Reed mixed in. But the number of impact players they've drafted since those first few seasons, really since 2012, I don't know that it's more than two or three. And you cannot survive without picking up impact players at a more prodigious rate. So, you know, first few years, Tom, I give them a 10. If I could go higher than that, I would. Honestly, I think it's as good a stretch of drafting as any GM and coach have ever had. How John Schneider didn't win Executive of the Year during that time is an embarrassment to the rest of the league. But the last few years, I don't know, I'm probably in that two or three range because I think that's been problematic and is the reason they needed to make the desperate move they made with Jamal Adams.
Now, in this situation, Mike, you talk about the desperate situation with Jamal Adams. You know, we're kind of talking about young players needing to step up and how important those guys are to this franchise overall, Salk. So do you believe it's more important for the star talent to continue to play at a star level or for the younger players to start developing and contributing in the way that this program and Pete and John have, hoping that they will step up in that fashion?
I hate to give you a cop-out answer, but both things are important. I don't know that this team can be the kind of Super Bowl contender that they want to be without both of those things being true. Yeah, your stars have to do star things. You need Jamal Adams to make big plays. You need Bobby Wagner to, you know, as we said, let Bobby eat. You've got to find ways for him to get free and make the kind of impact game-changing plays that you've paid him the huge money for. So obviously you need your stars to do it. But if they don't get anything from the group we were just talking about, Rasheem Green and LJ Collier and some of the other young guys, it's not going to matter, right? I mean, so I guess I would say if I had to choose, I would take the stars. Your stars have to play at a star level. I just think it's hard for them to do that unless the young players do their job. And they, you know, it doesn't mean they have to turn into stars themselves, although certainly that would be nice. But if you get nothing out of Collier and Green, well, you're not going to get enough pressure on the quarterback in all likelihood for Bobby Wagner or for, you know, any of the guys in the secondary to do the things that they're supposed to do to make big plays and act like stars.
Terrific stuff, Mike. We'll talk to you Friday.
All right, guys.
How do you tell whether or not an athlete is disgruntled or if they're being treated unfairly? We're going to explore that next as college football has been turned completely upside down. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
Here a scandal, there a scandal, everywhere a scandal. We've been talking about Washington State and, I don't know, do we call them accusations thrown at Nick Rolovich? Certainly, wide receiver Cassidy Woods had his side of the story, saying that Nick Rolovich cautioned him against joining the We Are United movement. And I think that was maybe just a big misunderstanding. Nick Rolovich, it's not that he is anti the We Are United movement. He's just cautioning his player against what might happen if he ends up not playing the season and observing that boycott. Now we got a story coming out of Colorado State where players and athletic department staff are saying that coaches have told players not to report COVID symptoms and threaten players with reduced playing times if they quarantine. And to follow that story up, you've got many players on that same team coming out and saying, no, this story is nonsense. I reported my symptoms. I was told by the training staff to do X, Y, and Z. This story is complete nonsense. So there's some people saying that there's a cover-up going on. Some people saying that the whole thing is ridiculous. How do you, when you guys read a story like this, how do you distinguish between players or staffers that may be disgruntled and saying one thing and players, on the other hand, that are saying, no, this whole thing is just not happening the way people are saying it is. What do you think, Jake? You've been in this environment before.
Yeah, I genuinely do believe that there are players that are on the team that are disgruntled. In college football, you have 90 to 100 guys on this roster, and not every single one of them the starter. Not every single one of them has their career gone the way that they have hoped. And I've seen some drastic things on one end of the spectrum to another in terms of the way guys handle it. And some players have tried to handle it by getting back after the coaches, the coaching staff, the athletic department in different ways, which sounds crazy. But again, I've seen it with my own two eyes. So it would not surprise me if there was a player that was out there at Colorado State that had leaked a report that this was going on. But as you see all these other players step up and defend Colorado State and say, this is crazy, this is not what's going on, not in the slightest, I believe those players over some anonymous source that's not willing to step up and say, hey, this is what's happened to me. At least with Cassidy Woods and in Washington State in that situation, at least the kid was man enough to say, hey, I'm the one that said that things were wrong and that Rolovich said this to me, blah, blah, blah. But when you have unnamed sources that can just, you know, say things from anonymity, you know, I don't trust that. I don't trust that whatsoever.
Yeah, it becomes tricky too when it's multiple sources from both sides, and especially multiple sources, like you said, Jake, within the same program. And that could have a lot to do with the different experience that two or more different athletes are having. Like with the Colorado State story, they said that there were 10 people they spoke to, but that wasn't just athletes. It was a mix of people that were in somehow the athletic department or somehow involved with sports at Colorado State, and then players on the football team. So it's, and then on the other hand, you have multiple players on the team that are refuting that. So again, it's really hard to tell where it's coming from, because I want to give credit to someone when they're coming from within the program, but then someone else coming from within the program saying it's fake is discrediting their own teammate, which is kind of weird to see. So I don't really know what to think of it, but all that makes me realize is how hard it'll be for college sports to try to monitor thousands and thousands and thousands of students in a way that the NFL has a much easier time with. It's not going to be easy with the NFL, but with college sports, not only do you have pressure that coaches might feel, what if there's a huge game the next day and your star quarterback tests positive? What do you do, right? Like, pressure's on the line. You have a couple $1 million of a bonus or whatever that's riding on this. You're incredibly nervous. There are boosters giving you pressure. On the other hand, you also have just monitoring all these students. So you look at the Rutgers story where there was football players that reportedly went to a party and they all got sick. Well, how do you monitor what all these kids at all these schools are going to do? It feels impossible.
I'm going to offer a theory on this, and it's not based on anything other than my own ability to read people, and I'm sure it's going to get me in trouble, but I have to say it.
Okay.
Because I honestly think that there's a link. I think when you're dealing with young kids, when they look at what's going on in the world right now, and they see groups of people demanding justice rightfully, people who have legitimate complaints, I think that there might be a tendency to look at themselves and say, oh, well, I don't like what's going on, so I'm gonna, you know, voice a complaint too. And what they may not understand is that not every complaint that's voiced has the same validity. These are college kids with no life experience or very limited life experience when it comes to this sort of stuff. And so they may think that any unpleasant experience that they have is an injustice worth making public, when in fact that might not always be the right way to go.
Well, and I can definitely understand that. And again, we're talking about 18 to 22-year-olds for the most part, and they're not going to handle everything the right way. And they're not going to say everything the right way. So this is a situation that I think is obviously sensitive. There's a lot of charged emotions when it comes around this topic and around all of this. And Stacey, you point out some really good, potential conflicts that you're going to run into with coaches and players and everybody involved in that particular university that's going to have to stand up and do the right thing in that moment? And is everybody going to have the mental fortitude to be able to do that, even if it means costing a game because your star player can't play? That part of it's going to be really interesting to see how it works out. And Tom, I think that there's going to be a lot of players in these situations that are going to go and say and do things not necessarily the right way, but trying to voice their opinion in somehow, some way. And that's where it's been really interesting with college football. On top of all of this, you have the We Are United and everything among the Pac-12. It's just a very interesting time in college sports and college football in particular. It just makes you really wonder, are they going to be able to have a season this year with so much turmoil that is around us right now? I hope that they can. I want to. I think they can. But, you know, with everything going on, it's sure going to make it extremely, extremely hard to pull off.
Tom, do you think they can? Do you think they will?
Are we talking about
have a college?
Are we talking
season?
About We Are United or Colorado State
specifically? Almost more UConn. So we heard this morning that UConn is not having their football season. Granted, UConn had already left their conference. They were going to play independently. They are not a great football team, but they still become the first FBS team to cancel its football season. So I think people are wondering if other programs will follow suit. I think programs like Alabama and Ohio State. And Clemson are light years away from doing that because nothing matters more than their football program to those schools. And they will try to do everything they can to have a season. But I think that it has made some people nervous that it's started some kind of small snowball.
So you're asking me, do I think
like
UConn
after hearing that news? No, after hearing the news of UConn this morning, did it make you any more nervous that there won't be a college football season?
Oh, no, because UConn doesn't have that kind of power, and they don't have that kind of sway. And right now, because they left the American Athletic Conference and they're independent, they're an inconsequential program if we look at it, you know, compared to all the Power Five conference teams. So, no, I don't think so. I think that if the Pac-12 teams... Pac-12 players really did boycott, I think that would have a much bigger effect on the landscape of college football nationally than anything UConn's done. Do you disagree? Am I missing something there?
No. No, I think that's how I interpreted it, is that it's not a program that shocked me, but I do have my doubts about how long a college football season will continue. For me, it's not because of UConn and whatever they decided this morning. It's because there are infinitely more teams and players and people to monitor than there are in the NFL.
Yogi Roth, a star with the Pac-12 Network, has thoughts on all of this stuff. I'm going to talk to him next. 710 ESPN Seattle.